Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Experience summer comfort for less. Explore our sale on curtains and bedding. Perfect time to update and freshen your home.
Linda, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colin.
It's great to get an expert opinion. I was in a male toilet over the weekend and I looked down into the urinal and there was a big lump of chewing gum looking back up at me. In all of your years of cleaning, you'd probably be no stranger to the likes of that, would you?
No, unfortunately, it was a common occurrence. Chewing gum, cigarettes, sweet wrappers, sweets even. You know, like somebody'd sucked and it gone, oh, I don't like this, and spat it into the urinal, rather than the bin that was close by.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's only 5 metres, maybe, if that, a couple of metres across the room. There's a bin sitting there, and the option is there to just spit the gum into the bin or take a piece of toilet paper and wrap it up in that. So did you ever get an understanding over how long were you a cleaner for?
I did office cleaning for about 7 years. Stopped for a few years and then I went into house cleaning, which was much easier. People have the standards in their home that they don't seem to have in the public, you know. So, but certainly doing offices and public spaces, I did pubs as well.
Oh God! Right, pubs.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be a special breed of cleaner to do that. And I must admit, any publican I worked for paid me more.
Right.
Seem to accept that. Yeah, this isn't a pleasant job.
It's kind of danger money, isn't it?
I reckon, you know, yeah, because you know people get sick. I remember walking into pub and the landlord looking at me and saying, "I'm really sorry about this. I actually had to close the toilets last night."
Why?
And he unlocked the door. Somebody had explosive diarrhea.
Oh, my God.
All over the toilet. Not just the bowl. It was on the floor. It was on the walls. The pair of us in unison looked at the ceiling and went, well, that's at least one relief. It took me 2 hours to clean it.
And I know this isn't, you know, I don't know whether people want detail on this, but we are trying to give people an insight into just how hard the job of cleaning is without something else being heaped on top of it. But the fact that it had been closed off overnight probably meant there'd been an element of drying in. So there was just kind of elbow grease involved on your end, isn't there?
Well, yeah. I mean, you've got hazardous material. Cause, I mean, they've been getting sick and, yeah, so it was just... Yeah, and as he said, the annoying thing for him is whoever had done it hadn't come out and said, look, I'm really sorry this has happened. A regular customer, he said he saw him walk to the toilet, stand at the toilet door, close the toilet door, get somebody else to stand and stop people going to the toilet while he came over and told the landlord about the state of the toilet.
Right.
They had literally just walked away. And you're there going, how? Mark you, I also, one time when I was cleaning offices, went in, because you often did those early in the morning, to find a condom in the urinal. And you stand there going, is there a universe that you actually think this is acceptable behaviour?
In the urinal. So again, you know, not in the bin and not a sort of a misconstrued attempt to flush it down one of the stalls.
On the floor, just into the... It's like they walked in, dropped it into the nearest... Yeah, I suppose it's marginally better than the sink, but...
marginally all right. Look, we do know it's lunchtime, and apologies, but given the mess caused around the country, on beaches that maybe the people would have seen over the weekend or their local swimming spot or that kind of thing, this is maybe in the air at the moment. People's lack of consideration towards all the hard work of Tidy Towns committees who are going out there trying to, you know, clean up a town and... get it to do a little better and raise the standards and a bit of pride in it. You would think that the same might apply in smaller spaces like offices, but given the insights you got over your decades as a cleaner, did you ever arrive at any conclusion as to why people are this way?
No. I mean, you know, I've actually spoken about this with people and they sort of looked at me and gone, but why would you do that? And it's a different mindset. They just seem to think this is a public space. I'm not responsible for it. someone, some nebulous someone, is. And they'll clean it up.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? That this idea of a nebulous someone, I mean, a lot of the people who do cleaning work, given the hours of it, early mornings, late nights, it might be a second job. It might be a parent, and most cleaners in those situations are women. It's mothers going out to earn an extra few quid to make their lives a bit easier. It's not some nebulous someone. It's someone with a name, someone with a family. It's a human being.
Yeah, it could well be your neighbour. You know, you don't know what they're doing. So really the question you should be asking yourself is, would I do this at home? You know, you go into toilets and offices and you're there going, could you at least try a name?
Yeah, there's...
Because it'd be, you know, sorry.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's true. There wouldn't be many successful auditions for sniper school in public toilets, would there?
No. A friend of mine took over a pub in the UK and he was renovating it and he was going through what he was doing. And I was sort of giving him, you know, years of experience. And he walked into the toilet and he went, I'm having this all wood panelled. And I just looked at him and went, yeah, good luck with that. And he sort of, well, no, that'll look really nice. It's going to stink within 6 months. I said, because it's wood. Doesn't matter how well painted or anything else it is, within 6 months, this toilet is going to stink. And 9 months later, he had to have all the panelling taken out.
Oh, he went ahead and did it anyway, did he?
I was not going to be that bad. I'm like, looking at him. And his wife's there going, she's telling me the truth. I said, no, it's not going to be that. You know, he just had this vision and off he went, yeah. And I say 9 months later, he looked at me. I just couldn't believe it. He said, my poor cleaner hasn't stopped moaning at me from day one. And I looked at him and said, yeah, I'm not surprised. I told you it was going to happen. I said, especially drunks. I said, whatever chance you have of people aiming when they're sober. I said, and I know from cleaning offices that they don't. I said, you've no chance once they're drunk.
Do you think it is better at home, though? I mean, you know, if people, and there may be people out there who have male and female children or male and female members of the household. I mean, the stand-up brigade in the morning, again, are not exactly bullseye merchants. By definition, sitting on the bowl is going to hit the target every time. So, I mean, people might be perplexed why people just don't, in a home situation, just sit down.
Well, I actually got to a stage, especially when my son became a teenager, I just turned around to the husband and to the son and went, no, I'm fighting this uphill battle and I'm not doing it anymore. You two clean the toilet. Work it out between yourselves, but I want that toilet cleaned every week.
Yeah. You didn't want a busman's holiday at home.
No. I said, I clean it every week and I'm cleaning up after you two. I said, just because you think you can, standing up doesn't mean you can. Now you can clean it.
Right. And did the gunslingers do it?
Well, you had no bloody option about it. You know, right. I had just, no, that's it.
Okay. I again, and I know it's lunchtime, but, you know, or ish post-lunchtime, which is nearly just as bad. A phenomenon I've noticed in stalls in male toilets, and a lot of them I've gone into in a variety of places, is on the wall of the stall. Sometimes people go in and, you know, they don't want to be doing it in public, so they go in and they clean out their nose and they give the nose a good pick. But instead of wiping off their finger on a piece of toilet paper and depositing that in the toilet, they wipe it on the wall of the stall. I mean, again, who does that?
I don't know. I would love to know.
Have you ever come across it?
Oh, numerous times. You know, when you go in to check the toilet, you're not sort of looking just at the floor. And anybody that's done public toilets, you know, pubs, restaurants, whatever, offices, you go in and you check the floor, the back wall, and then the two side walls and the back of the door. Now, you'd think somebody sitting on the toilet wouldn't reach the back of the door, but yes, they would have managed to wipe it on the back of the door.
But is it a male or a female or both?
Both.
Both.
Yes, so, you know, having done both, you know, you're there going, Now, you wouldn't, surely to God you would not do this at home. But yeah, they do it, you know. I can understand that if the toilet paper was, there was no toilet paper left, you thought, well, what do I do with this? But yeah, there's obviously toilet paper there. Carry tissues with you. Because, you know, sooner or later, everybody has to blow their nose at some stage.
But it's a longer stretch to the toilet door or to the stalls on either side than it is to just reach out and take a piece of toilet paper and either blow your nose, clean your nose with that piece of toilet paper, or at least clean your fingers off with the piece of toilet paper. I mean, it takes effort to do this.
Yeah. And the annoying thing is, because it's been there for nearly 24 hours, it's rock solid. Oh. So you have to go in, spray it with the cleanser, go off and clean up a bit, do the rest of your cleaning, come back, and I actually used to keep a little nail brush specifically for removing dried on. Yeah. Because
snot, right, yeah.
Oh, it's, you know, it. You could rub it, and all you end up doing is just smearing it, and you know, going over a bigger and bigger space, trying to get this off.
And did you pick up any kind of tips for cleaning this kind of stuff over time? Did you end up assembling a toolkit, like you say, you bring a nail brush in there? I mean, did you have a putty scraper and all sorts of stuff in there for cleaning up?
Yeah, old credit card, good spray, strong spray. Cleanser,
right.
So that you get it soaked, get it soft, and use the credit card to scrape as much off as you can. Sometimes give it another spray,
right.
Then go back with the nail brush and give it a final scrub over, and then wipe it down again.
The poor old credit
card. It could take you about 10-15 minutes to do it.
All right, but to put that in context, though, you're under time pressure as a cleaner. Like, I mean, I have limited experience of this. About 30 plus years ago, I worked as a cleaner on the North German ferries between Sweden and Germany. And the ferry pulls in, the passengers get off. They were mostly coming from Sweden to Kiel in the north of Germany to buy their duty free. And actually, once they passed a certain water limit in the middle of the Baltic outside of Swedish waters, the duty free shop opened. And you can imagine the state of some of the cabins after that. But you're under time pressure. You have to undress the beds, get the cabins back in order and all of that kind of thing. So, you know, you've got limited hours. I presume you're given your hours at the start of the week and said, right, it's 2 hours in the office. You don't have that 15 minutes to spend dealing with somebody else's snot or whatever else.
You sort of standing there going, right, well, if I cut the corner on that job, that will give them the time to do this. Yeah. So you're constantly sort of rearranging your schedule because you've suddenly got a job that may on the surface look quite small, but because the time, how long it's gone on, offices would be heated and everything would dry and all the rest of it. And of course, as soon as you add, it softens, but it doesn't always remove itself.
Right.
It's still adhering. So you could end up having to make two or three trips to clean off a small area.
Mm. Now, it should be said, in the job that I had, it was kind of, we used to get paid an hour extra if there was puke in the bathroom.
Yeah.
You'd be sent down the corridor. There was a special puke spray. I don't know what was in it. It kind of deodorised the puke. And then you'd clean it up. Did you have that?
A lot of the pubs I worked in would have something similar for the same reason. And one of the landlords actually had a very specific bucket and mop, and he changed the mop head regularly. And that was all it was used on, was cleaning up puke. You know, you didn't use it on any of the floors or anything else. You went in, and God bless that man, when he discovered he'd cleaned up most of it himself, before he went to bed, he'd spray it up the area with the spray. So you'd walk in and go, right, somebody got threw up here, and you go in. But you do walk in and it's just dried up on the floor and things.
Right.
It takes longer, but most places where drunks are around, they tend to have, you know, a biohazard spray for it. And of course, in Sweden, they call those ferries booze cruises.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I have my sympathy.
It does exactly what it says on the tin. Come here. I'm sorry. I mean, part of me is sorry for kind of re-triggering you on this, but we are going to keep you with this because we do need an expert voice of experience on the line. I want to come back to you on a few other things.
Yeah.
Stephen, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. How are you?
You were listening to Linda there on the other line talking about her experience as a cleaner and, you know, some of the things that make you look at the messes that get left behind and just ask the question, like, who does that?
Yeah, that's what I do. We're an exterior cleaning company in Dublin and we'd often go into town, around the shops, all the busy roads and stuff like that, and cleaning up after a night out, you know, especially like on Monday morning, we'd be sent in to a few different roads there and cleaning up after the pubs. Could be chewing gum or graffiti. And the new one that it's pretty hard to get up is the stickers from the vapes.
Right. Why? What is it about them?
That's the new thing. I actually saw it on RT a few months ago. I didn't realise it was a problem until I saw it on TikTok. I don't smoke myself or vape, but when the young kids are open the packet, there's a little sticker on the end on the top of it where you pull from, and they're going out their way to stick it on top of the bin. And you go to any Spar or Centre or one of these shops in town.
Yeah, convenience shops of any kind, yeah.
Yeah, one of them, yeah. And they'd be full. You'll notice it now that if you haven't heard it already, but they'd be full of them wee little stickers, and they're a pestograph. They're really difficult and time-consuming. And obviously, it's costing the business, I suppose, some of their profits, you know, because we're going there and spending an hour at a little small bin just to clean the top of it off, you know.
And like, how many of them are you? You're talking dozens of them just stuck to the top of the bin.
No, hundreds and hundreds. Like, I think they go out of their way to do it. Instead of putting the sticker onto the pack where they bought the vape and then throwing that in the bin, they go out of their way to stick it on the top and leaves residue. It's crap to look at, you know.
Like, right. It's not, I suppose once one person does it, other people think it's the done thing, and then it just builds up and builds up. Yeah. So how do you get them off?
There's different sprays you can go. Like the other girl, you need some sort of like a credit card, like a strong card, and you spray it on, you let the adhesive remover work its way in, you know, and then you just scrape it off. Well, it could be a long time at one bin, like, and you could be doing a lot better with your time, you know, than doing one bin, and that's it, you know, for the council or for the shops.
Right, and you're as you say, an exterior cleaning company. You're talking about using solvents and power washers and all of that kind of thing. Was there any particular reason why you went down that line of work? Did you ever do the indoor stuff that put you in contact with the toilets Linda's talking about?
No, never done it. Not yet, anyway. But we started just exterior power washing because my brother was into the window cleaning. So
right.
We saw there was a need for that. So, I mean, that's what we got into now. And yeah, it's keeping us busy, and there's no shortage out there of work, and like places are always getting wrecked, and we have the same shops coming back to the same shops, and some of the big supermarkets we go to spray paint cans of, I don't know what they are, graffiti, you know, they're tagging the buildings and stuff, you know.
And once you clean it off, do they just come back and do it again? It's kind of a cat and mouse thing, is it?
Well, that's it. Like, for me, I get paid, but it's not. It's just an eyesore more than anything. Like, the same shop keeps calling us back in town. There's one in town there, I think it's in Talbot Street, and the glass gets sprayed, which is not. That's easy to clean. But when they spray the paint, the stonework, that's hours and hours, and sometimes you can't fully remove it because it has shadows and stuff like that.
And what you're talking about, just endlessly kind of power washing the same spot and basically just trying to, it's like you're just trying to use erosion to get rid of it, are you?
Well, that's it, yeah. Erosion and obviously the chemicals we're using, which we don't really like to be around chemicals. I know there's a lot of other companies that offer that every time, chemicals and stuff like that. And like, no, we don't want to put our lads using chemicals every day, you know. It's not, even though we have the masks, we have all the PPE, all the training, something you don't want to stick around, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, it's your job. You earn money at it, as you say. You're kind of, you know, fairly even tempered about it. But at the same time, when you come back and you're doing the same thing over and over again, I mean, do you ever wonder about the kind of mentality of people who keep doing this? And do you ever feel a bit disrespected by it, that people don't really respect the job you've done the last time and go out of their way to make it tougher again?
Yeah, I think the people who are doing it are not thinking of the next person or what it's looking like, tourists coming over to the country and the place all tagged up or sprayed or graffiti, you know, chewing gum everywhere. People aren't thinking of, like, we need to keep the city clean and, you know, we want to look well, you know. But then there's people like us that go out there scraping and spraying at 5 a.m. or 4 a.m, which it would be great if we could just go to work at normal time, you know, because we obviously have to get in there earlier, you know.
Yeah.
So we're not in anybody's way, but...
Right, and do the hours suit you? I mean, are you back in the office then kind of doing admin, or is that you kind of wrapped for the day once you've kind of got your early morning shift out of the way?
No, if I'd done the early mornings, I'd start at 4 or 5 and then I'd just go back on to the normal house washing at 8 o'clock. I'd start the machine, first job at 8 o'clock, so I have to make sure I'm back in Swords or Clondalkin or wherever I am.
Right.
For 8 o'clock, you know.
And how long a day is it, generally speaking? Like, give us an insight into kind of your beginning to end time.
Yeah, because I work for myself, like, you're starting 4, 6, 8 o'clock in the morning, depends, and you're doing a 10 or 12 hour shift, you know, most days. And then you're going home and then on the laptop, and then sure, you're getting texts at 11 o'clock at night, and so you answer every message, you know.
Right.
Because as it's your own business, every message is a potential customer you'll be lost and given to someone else, you know. So it never stops, even when you're sitting and watching the kids, playing with the kids in the evening, phone still beeping. Well, you just have to do it, you know. You can't
I suppose
complain.
That's the nature of the business. It's somebody who's running an 8-by business. There's a mess and outside the door. They want somebody there to clean it up first thing in the morning. So they're probably contacting you late.
That's it. And everybody wants it done yesterday, you know. No one wants something like that done. They can't wait for the 2 weeks that, like, we're probably booked out for 2 or 3 weeks at a time.
Right.
Nobody can wait for that. So, you know.
Have you ever seen anyone doing it?
No, not. I don't. I think they're probably doing it later at night, like 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, maybe something like that. Because I'm not ever out that time, so we never see anybody doing it. To be honest,
right.
Never around.
All right, thanks, Stephen. Anya, you're not in the business of cleaning. Well, it might be said you were forced into the business of cleaning, but you did see a perpetrator.
Well, I'm
doing
glad
something
I'm not
that
into
was very.
Purpose.
Go on, yeah.
I feel nauseous after listening to that poor lady cleaning up the bathroom.
Linda, yeah.
And it seems like my complaint or observation is mild after that. So I live in a small, a village, a beautiful village, a great community spirit, great tidy towns. But anyway, I'm looking out my window one day. This was last summer, beautiful sunny evening. A pub door opened across the way and this guy gets out of his car and just walks behind the car and piddles on the street.
What time of the day was it?
7 o'clock in the evening.
In the summer, as you say.
In the summer.
Broad daylight.
The pub across the road, door open of the pub, and he just piddles on the street. I couldn't believe it.
And where were you? Were you looking out the upstairs window?
Yes, yeah.
Right. And there was your man outside your house, was it?
Outside the house, having a piddle. Now, there was a girl with him and she obviously said something to him because I could hear him saying back to her, "Oh, nobody cares except you." I was completely gobsmacked. Anyone walking around could see him.
All right. Was he the driver or the passenger, do you know?
You see, had I seen him getting out of the driver, I would have taken the number plate. But I just literally saw him walking behind the car.
Right.
And then he walked across the road. And by the time I came downstairs, I was going to put a note on the car window. Not that it would have made any difference to somebody who would do that. The car was gone.
Right.
So they obviously just went into the shop or something and were gone.
Oh, right.
It was just horrible.
And was there anywhere, like, let's give somebody the total benefit of the doubt here and say that an emergency occurred and he badly needed to go to the toilet and he's listening right now, racked with remorse that he has done such a thing, although his words would seem to indicate not. Was there any toilet anywhere nearby he might have been able to use?
Literally, all he had to do was walk across the road and there's a pub with a door open and two toilets in it.
Right. And politely ask, would you mind if I used your toilet?
I wouldn't even say he would have to ask. There's two doors even.
Right.
Just in he'd walk and nobody would even ask. He'd just, the pub, you could hear the chitter chatter from people. It was full. It was a sunny August evening. Bright as can be, 7 o'clock. I could not believe that anyone would do that on the street.
Maybe he'd been long enough in a pub before that, and that's the reason he was hopping out.
But he was
blissfully unaware of his surroundings.
Driving.
All right.
I was positive he was driving, but by the time I came downstairs, it was literally 2 minutes later. I was in such shock when the car was gone.
Right, and the woman who was with them was obviously mortified. Whatever she said from inside the car, anyway, she probably said it pretty sharply, given his reaction back to her.
Yeah. He didn't care. He just said, nobody gives it except you.
Right. Oh, he
was his reaction.
And you could hear him, so he was shouting back at her, was he?
Well, they were literally outside my door, so I could hear the conversation. Probably had the window open, and I could hear, I didn't exactly hear what she said to him, but the answer back was, oh, nobody gives it except you.
Right. And did you, were you tempted to open the window and go, get the hell away from my hedge there?
Well, you know, you have to be so careful.
I know.
You know, you do that, and I certainly didn't recognise him from around, but you still, you're kind of a target if you do that.
Mm.
It's such a difficult thing, you know, because
well, you're probably
horrible.
A bit shocked as well in the beginning. So I mean, you know, let's say the average urination takes 30 to 40 seconds, and if there was drink taken, it could be longer. Let's take him up to a minute. By the time you've seen him, you're gobsmacked. By the time you're actually assured yourself of what he's doing, he's 20 seconds in. You know, he'd probably only have about 5 seconds left by the time you opened the window to him. So
I didn't time it now.
Yeah. Right. No, I'm sure you didn't.
It was so disgusting.
Did you ring anyone?
Was.
Did you? Were you tempted to ring the guards at all?
No, I was actually talking to the guard the next day and I said, you know, I was so tempted to throw a few eggs. Only my eggs were organic. I said, I'm not going to waste them on his car.
No.
But by the time I came downstairs, anyway, the car was gone.
Hmm. And away you went. I suppose the other insult is, as you say, you didn't recognise him from around. In a small village, the thought that somebody would come specially to your village and the only thing they'd have to offer would be to leave that on your doorstep.
I know. Yeah. It was disgusting.
How long ago was that?
That was last August. A nice sunny evening last August.
And he never
came... I'm really sure it was August.
He never came back, did he?
To clean it up? No, definitely not.
Would you know him if you saw him?
No, never.
Right.
Obviously,
we're not looking to identify him publicly on the airwaves, but, you know, I mean, you would, if you met him along the street, I suppose you'd probably.
No.
No. Okay.
Because I'm kind of looking down on him, so I don't really. I saw him going across the road to maybe try and get something, get into a restaurant. So I'm walking across and then walking back. So he obviously, you know, didn't get a table or whatever and then drove off.
Okay, well, you were looking down on him both from the moral high ground and the upstairs window, to be fair to say, Anya.
Yeah, absolutely.
All
absolutely.
Right. Okay, we'll take a break back after this. Thanks, Anya. Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815. Now, we're going to move to something else, and that is the announcement by the American president that on August 1st, tariffs of 30% could be imposed on goods coming from the EU into the US, which Maro Šefčovič, the EU trade commissioner, said today would make trade between the US and the EU nigh on impossible. Mary Sadler, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Colin.
Tell us about your business.
So we make a cream liqueur. We're based down here on our family farm in County Meath between Navan and Kells. And it's on the premium end because it's only got premium ingredients in it in the form of just its core ingredients. So we export to the US. So this directly affects how we navigate the next few months.
All right. How many people have you got working for you?
Actually, that's a good question. We've had to move to a much more flexible workforce. So overall, we've 35 people in total. And they're sort of working weekends. We're mostly retail hospitality, so you'd be working Wednesday through Sunday with us.
Right. And Kamir, what has the mood been like? So, you know, since probably the beginning of this year and during the US election campaign, there's been a lot of talk about tariffs. Then we got a bit more clarity on the rate of those tariffs. They could have been up as much as 25%. There's a baseline tariff of 10%, mm-hmm. and now we're looking at possibly 30%. So even whether or not this comes to pass, what's the effect on morale in a business like yours?
It's you've no choice, really. You've got to pay the bills. So morale stays up. You're constantly trying to innovate and find angles and directions. You know, we've very good partners in the United States. It's a great market, so I'll pretext all of it by saying we're not leaving it. So we're committed to it. We've invested quite a bit in it over the last 10 years. So, and it's a really rock solid market for us. And the mood is, it's the uncertainty. The rates you can always figure out because, you know, you don't want them, but they're your, it's a profit and loss exercise. You know, you got to figure it out yourself, but it's the uncertainty. I'm in a business known as the fast moving consumer goods. And that's because if you miss a week of planning, say I miss a shipment in September, it just doesn't go out. It takes 6 weeks to get to the States. So it's, if it doesn't go out at the beginning of October, it's November by the time it's hit. So I may have missed the Christmas market. So that's the problem, is the level of uncertainty. Do you go now? Do you go next week? You know, if you've shipped it, will you be caught in the middle of a, you know, the duty has been known to go on with this administration for 3 days. So you could have been just unlucky and landed in your stock at the port on day two of the 3 days, paid the duty, and then it's gone on day four. So there's a lot of uncertainty out there is the single biggest problem.
And what's been the strategy so far? So, you know, you've nothing at the higher rate has happened yet, or there is this baseline 10% that's going on at the moment. Has your tendency been like the pharmaceutical companies here to go, look, let's get as much of our stuff moved and ramp up production now to try and get in ahead of this 30% deadline? Or has, not to make a pun about it, has the ship sailed on that? Because effectively what you're talking about, a 6 week shipping time, mean that you're never going to get increased stock in now before that 30% deadline?
You see, first of all, to do anything big like that, you need a big balance sheet, and only very large multinationals have that. The rest of us are operating off really tight working capital, and like, I don't want to bore your listeners now, but you know, you need a lot of money to make mistakes or to build up inventory. You need cash, like you need to be able to put it on the table to get it out there. So very few companies like myself would be operating with that much margin or that much fuel in the tank. So you just are creative, and you're constantly talking to your partners to figure out what's the best way to do it. We were lucky; we actually got in before the 20%, at the 10%. Sorry. So, but look, the first of all.
But what does creative mean? I mean, that's you know what that means. But for somebody out there, you know, who's not in, say, the entrepreneurial end of things at all, who hears this thing about tariffs and they're wondering, what does this mean? What does it mean for Irish business? What does it mean for Irish jobs? What does it mean for you as a person? And how do you get creative if margins are tight and you're expected to suck up some of the 30% hit on your end?
But that's your everyday in business. So by getting creative, you're constantly looking at your cost base and your revenue base. And we can't fix pricing. Suppliers cannot name the price. It's up to the retailer the retailer to name the price of a product. So we take the price and we work backwards. So things like getting creative are, we work under a thing called an import model in the US. And that import model has a couple of, you know, it's got about 10 rules under it. So you keep going through the rules to see if there's somewhere in there you can just find a way in, you know, that'll give you a bit of leeway to get to the next place. But it really is. And it's the uncertainty. And what it means for jobs is just really material. I'll give you an analogy. It's as if we're all in a Formula One race and the guy in the front just smacks on the brakes for no apparent reason. And there's just massive collateral damage caused by nobody coming up. You know, there was no warning system. There was nothing given. And that's your problem. You're just going to get this pile up of kind of things we had wanted to do, but now you got to wait because you got to wait for the next decision, for the dude to tell the next guy, and for the negotiations to end. And so for somebody like us, that's tough. And having said that, for somebody as small as us, there's sometimes really nice little things that you can pick up. Like we have just opened a couple of new US markets because of the demand for the brand. And they're all on the East Coast and they just work very well based on my import model. So it's kind of like it's like a jigsaw puzzle. You're constantly trying to find the piece that will complete that piece of the jigsaw for you. But if you've thousands of pieces, you know, you're playing all the time with different kind of, and every morning under this administration, you wake up, the jigsaw piece has changed. The picture on the box changed.
And then the shifting picture on this end, because I think anyone who's been to the supermarket and has seen, you know, the price of a pound of butter rise by at least a euro in some cases, know that, you know, dairy input costs, which are going to be big for you, are a factor in this as well. You say you're working on a farm, so do you own the herd that supplies the milk to you?
Yeah, we're dairy farmers, beef right. and sheep, yeah.
I did see an article in the paper over the weekend about another cream liqueur that was talking about playing music to the cattle in their supply herd. Are you? Is there a playlist for the cattle in the herd you're dealing with?
No, we're very lucky. We're based up here in County Meath, so there's plenty of very, very good grass. So I don't have to play any music. But from a business perspective, it's very different to the farm. But even in terms of the butter going up in price, I mean, you've also got to ask, there's a major reshift coming and it's based on volume to price. So as volume drops, price will go up. And that's primarily because, you know, for a lot of products, we've been paying either below cost or very close to cost. So there's, you know, are we talking about a price correction that's necessary? Or are we just going to keep supporting price, low price of food?
Right.
So, you know, there's a big debate to be had on it.
And going back to the States, though, you know, so you've got obviously you are a cream liqueur, but there's going to be reciprocal tariffs potentially if this 30% tariff is imposed on the US side. So on the mm-hmm. EU side of things, then there could be, and last time around, in order to put pressure on the Trump administration, Kentucky bourbon was hit, for example, so that a Republican voting state would feel the pinch directly mm-hmm. through bourbon exports. And then in kind, the US looked at things like French wine and Irish whiskey and those kind of things. So apart from the baseline 30%, are you open to potentially a further ramping up if there is reciprocal tariffs by the EU?
Yeah, you could be. Like, in the last administration, the tariffs were threatened. And somehow or another, they were threatened on the divil and all, and somehow the threat stayed and got put on cream liqueurs. They didn't get put on anything else. So we've had 2 years of 20% tariffs in the US. Biden came in and removed them.
Right.
So we've been here before. And I just, it's literally, I know it's an awful boring answer, but it literally is day by day. You're just, you know, we're in the eye of the storm now. It's very hard to change direction. You've got to just really hold on to the tiller and say, you know, for every awful thing that happens, it's funny, a good thing will open up to you. You know, we found out the other day that a bottle of Cool Swan is sold every hour in New York City. And like
In supermarkets or the equivalent in measures in pubs, because maybe people might notice the increase in, you know, as much in a bar setting where they're willing to pay a premium on the venue and all of that. But, you know, where
the bar will know, you see, and they'll switch you out. So the bar will know, because the consumer at the end of the day is the price taker, and then we in the middle work. But no, we're retail. So the bottle a day is in retail. Is where we're selling a bottle a day in New York. So that was really nice. You hear things like that, and then you realise you have a base and you can probably do a little bit different investment.
Right. Sorry, did you say a bottle an hour or a bottle a day at first? Was it a bottle?
Sorry, a bottle an hour.
A bottle an hour. Okay, right.
Yeah. God, you had me. Oh, yeah, I was talking myself down there. It's a bottle an hour.
A bottle an hour, good one.
Sold in New York, yeah.
Right. So, I mean, look, you're not going to have any clarity on this until August 1st. So, I mean, do you have any meetings with people? Do you kind of manage this all in your own head? I mean, what is this?
Oh, no, I'll be in Boston next Monday and then I'm off to Texas the following week. So, yeah, you get out and you press the flesh and you keep your relationships open. I mean, I suppose from my perspective, having had it in 2018, and the funniest thing about 2018 was we were totally alone. There was nobody else experienced it. So Irish whiskey didn't get us. I think it was Kerry, like butter. It was all dairy based, seemed to hold on to the tariff, and we got caught in that as an alcohol. And I remember that was super tough because everybody else was like, "Well, I'm okay, John," and they kept walking on. This time, it's going to affect everybody. So everybody is very collegiate. Everybody's very collaborative because nobody's getting out from underneath this kind of these kind of constant announcements. So people are working together. There's a lot of collaboration going on to try and get people their product and to try and keep businesses open. So in that regard, I suppose I'm slightly more positive maybe because we did have it in 2018, but it was very isolating in 2018. I'll never forget it. It was really like, hang on, help. And nobody really understood us because they weren't experiencing it. Now we're all experiencing it.
And what are they saying from the American end? I mean, you go to people that say, you know, those shops in New York that are selling a bottle an hour. I mean, what are they saying back to you? Or when you land in Boston and you've got the same issues going to affect you, what do they say to you about, are they looking for a price reduction from your end? Are they just telling you the bad news? Are they complaining about the policy? What do they tell you?
You know, I'm working in the States with this brand over 10 years. They're very stoic. They don't really give out. You give them your numbers, you tell them what's going to happen, and you figure it out between you. But you don't land and they're not like, oh my God, Tara, what are you going to do when this can't happen? You kind of sit with them and you say, look, because of the tariffs, but you've also got to be respectful of their business. If I'm lumping on huge costs, it affects their line as well. So between the two of you, try to figure out, is there an easy way to get it to market? Or, you know, but one way or the other, I can guarantee you prices are going to go up. That's like today, I can guarantee they're going to go up. Whether we land on 30% or it's pulled again on the 1st of August and we go again, maybe it'll happen in October. And maybe we get 30% and maybe it'll go to 60%. The thing is, this is really where that thing of control the controllables, I remember being explained that when I was doing my degree. People kept saying, in a business, control the controllables. And I didn't really understand what it really was until recently. I can only control what's in front of me. So we try to keep it very much on that vibe and look for growth. We're really determined to grow through this.
And in the best case scenario, and I know this is trying to find, scrabbling to find a silver lining in this particular cloud, if it comes to a point where, you know, the tariffs are stood down, could you keep some of what was built into that tariff and the expectation of what people might pay for what's already a premium product to maybe charge a higher unit price when the dust clears on all of this and kind of make up for some of the revenue that was lost during this uncertainty?
Now, you see, you asked me how do you figure these things out. That's one of them. You know, that's where you suddenly get a window and you take the margin bit that you've made and you try to flatten it out. Like, so just in case any, you know, I'm a consumer as well. So if you're listening thinking, these guys don't really know what their price is. Our first determination is to keep the business open. And then it's to keep our partner's business open and also to get the product to the customer. And in there, price is an element of that. And then I have a number of other levers that I can use. But overall, our goal is to get it at a value price to a customer, not cheap, because cheap, it means traditionally, or means just generally, you'd have to kind of downgrade your ingredients. We don't look for cheap, we look for value. We look to really understand, does the customer get value for this product? Is it something where they said, I enjoyed that, that was a good price for it? So, yes, and we're constantly moving the levers to see where we go. But your landscape never stays the same in business, like never. I mean, 3 years ago, we couldn't get a shipping container. This time now, this year, like, I could have 5 or 6 of them in the field, you know, and I don't keep them in the field, but you know what I mean? There's so many of them available. Like, there's always some. I mean, we had the port strike last November, and it only lasted 7 days, but it was right in the middle of us shipping our Christmas product to the US. So I had to airlift it. I mean, that was 10 times the cost of shipping it. So you're constantly playing with numbers. It's not.
Do you enjoy it? Like, you're talking about things coming at you from all angles. Like, you know, I know a lot of business people, they start up their own business. Part of them, you know, revels in the challenge of, you know, turning a book and building something and, you know, growing it from there. There's a whole challenge bit to it. But I mean, the stress side of it, how do you manage that? Or is that just part of it and always has been?
You have to manage it. You do, like you just do, I run a lot. And so you have to get it out of your system. And the other way you manage the stress is we sit down here every 3-4 months and we say, are we moving forward? Like, are we going backwards or are we actually gaining ground? And when you're gaining ground, you sort of say, well, stick with it. You know, this is going somewhere. I don't know where it's going, but it's going somewhere. I mean, we had lovely data out of the UK last week. I mean, where our sales are up week on week 400% in the UK without us increasing any number of stores, which means I've increased my customer base, you know. So there's days like that you think, yes, because there's only 4 of us here in an office doing this. And there's tremendous satisfaction in it. But yeah, you'd have to have my temperament to think this was satisfying. But it is the key to it, managing the stress is, are we moving forward? Can we see, is the light at the end of the tunnel becoming more and more visible, or are we going backwards? Because backwards is really hard. That's You can't go backwards. That'll eat you alive. But at least if you're making progress, there's a reason to get up.
Okay. Claire O'Sullivan, good afternoon to you.
How are you doing? Hello.
Good. Yeah, you're operating on a smaller scale again. Do you export to the US?
Oh my God, listening to that lady, I was thinking, gosh, she's on the ball. I am tiny in comparison. Yeah, we export to the US. We were selling directly to consumers over there. And they really make seaweed products. I make a range of seaweed skincare. It's called Wazzy. And they really loved our products. And we had one store there at the start of the year. And I had signed up for a trade show in New York. And I was umming and ahhing, what's the point in doing this? But unfortunately, I was already committed to it. So we went and we did it. And we ended up coming home with 10 stores from it, which is a big deal for a tiny little business. I mean, I'm a one-woman show.
Yeah, how tiny?
My partner. And,
yeah, give us a sense of of how tiny and where you are.
I'll give you a real sense of how tiny I am. I have a workshop here in Bantry. At the moment, I'm in my car because my two kids are inside in the corner of the workshop working away, doing their thing. So I had to come out here in the car to talk to you so I'd have a bit of peace and quiet. And I can still hear them roaring for me. My mom's down here with me this morning. You know, me, we're putting together our bath salts now this morning. But we've been going, and it's growing, and we're gaining great traction. And, I mean, this year I had huge hopes. I was taking on 2 full-time employees. I was buying a beautiful labelling machine so I could just make more product. And I was kind of thinking, look, we'll get away with it. They'll still buy it, but 30% tariff, not a chance.
Right.
Not a chance.
And so it's literally, that's the tipping point, is it? You were kind of coping with the baseline 10%-ish and that kind of thing. But when it started talking about 30, that's a game changer,
is
it?
Oh, it will be. I mean, the stores, I know the people in the stores now, and for them, they were saying they can't see. Like, they can see their stores closing because a lot of them are kind of Irish and stock my box.
Right.
And it's going to be massive for them. That means everything that they're bringing in, and it's not just me. There's loads of small businesses like myself that export to them, and those stores will be closing because of this.
And you're kind of aiming for the kind of premium market pretty much as well, are you? I mean, part of it is kind of Irish America. You've got your Irish origin story to tell, and seaweed is, you know, of course, an ingredient synonymous with Ireland. But you'd be looking to broaden it out from there into the kind of the premium end of things, would you?
Yeah, well, I suppose the trouble is all my ingredients are probably as expensive as you can get. I've been putting in the best quality ingredients. The seaweed is all hand-harvest seaweed. I've priced them at, all of my products, I have them priced where I could afford them. That's what I always go for, is, if I went into a shop and I picked this up, would I be turned off by the price? And it's always, look, I could afford this. And I wouldn't feel comfortable increasing the price. I can't imagine that, you know, people would feel, happy suddenly seeing a massive increase in something that they've been buying every couple of weeks for themselves, you know, especially by 30%. I mean, it's not just us that are hit with the these huge increases in products in our supermarkets. People on the other side of the water are the same, you know.
And did you have people? Do the people who you had lined up to take on? I mean, did you ultimately take them on, or did they know you were thinking of taking them on? And did you take them on ultimately?
No, it's put on pause.
Right.
It's put on pause. Yeah.
And what was their reaction to that?
That has a knock-on effect for everything. Do you know when you think you've got... Because it was going to be gorgeous working down here in the workshop where it's a very small family business. It's my mom, my partner helps me out when he's off work, and my cousin Simon's amazing as well. And then there was 2 other women that were going to come down here. It was just going to be perfect for them. Their kids were at school. You know, they're kind of well-reared now, and they were going to get back into the workforce. So now they're looking for, what are we going to do now? You know, they have to... So you wouldn't think it, but Trump and his notions, they're having a huge knock-on effect for, people just like that, you know?
Yeah, that's the kind of the human reality behind those announcements people hear in the news.
Yeah, that actually on a local level, or, somebody who's just, you know, I'm getting back to work now. My kids can take care of themselves in the evening when they come home from school. I have a job. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be, we have such a lovely time down here, you know. It's not,
It's not like a huge factory or anything like that. We're all in the middle of everything. It's chaotic for the most part. It's like you're doing this 1 minute and you have to sort of switch to another job the next, you know. But like the lady that was talking there, it is like fighting fires at the moment.
Right.
There's so much coming at us from all directions.
Okay, well, we have a bit of break up on the line, but look, the very best of luck to you. And it may not come to pass. Maybe you'll be able to take on those people. And for anyone out there who's been listening in and wants to contribute on this or indeed on our earlier items on human behaviour and what it leaves cleaners cleaning up, 087-484-8888 for your WhatsApps, 51551 for your text, liveline@rte.ie for your emails. We'll take a break, back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Cullum O'Mungoin here, 087-484-8888 for your WhatsApps. Now, people might have seen the pictures there over the weekend of Donald Trump joining in with the Chelsea team as they won the Club World Cup, and they were being presented with the trophy, and the FIFA chief was, I suppose, trying to discreetly usher him away from the proceedings, but Donald Trump decided he was going to hang on and photobomb the proceedings in the finest traditions, perhaps, of Charlie Haughey and Shane Ross, who themselves had attached themselves to high profile sports achievements in the when Stephen Roach won the Tour de France and Katie Taylor came home triumphant, respectively. But anyway, it can be awkward to move people on, as Gianni Infantino found out. And one of those situations, it's moving people on from your train seat. Patrick Conlon, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colin. How are you?
Yeah, you had this to tackle. Maybe you had some sympathy for Gianni Infantino trying to move Donald Trump from centre stage into the wings. You had to move people from your seat on the train. How did that come about?
Well, I was on the train from Dublin to Ockram and then on to Ennis. And I had an assigned seat number. But when I got onto the train and the carriage weren't clearly identified, you know, the A, B and C carriage ticket. So I was rooting around trying to find my seat, and eventually I got to my seat, but there was a couple already seated there. There was no actual electronic signal there saying that I was at my correct seat or whatever it is.
All right, so normally for people who, maybe don't travel by train that often, there's a little kind of a narrow screen up above the window that'll either have the number of the ticket you've bought or the name of the passenger, if you want to include that, to prove that that's the reserved seat. So that wasn't working, was it not?
It wasn't working, no. And the couple that were actually at my seat were showing me tickets that they had purchased at a kiosk. And I checked their tickets and there was no evidence whatsoever of where they should sit or how they should be accommodated on the train. But I just showed them my seat reservation and they just inquired what they would do should they be on that train, in other people's way, so to speak.
Right. And was the train full? Was there kind of demand on seats?
No, it wasn't full, but I was just trying to go by the rules, as the fellow says, and that's when you have a seat allocation that you take it and that you don't sort of be in somebody else's way, then should they come to their seat where they had the seat allocation. So it's just kind of by playing by the rules. But the thing that annoyed me about more was that there wasn't really any sign of any persons there that you could sort of look to get a little bit of help if you should find yourself in difficulty. It was just kind of like one of those situations. You got your train ticket, you boarded the train, and you did your thing. And if it worked out, it worked out. And if it didn't, it didn't. Then you're really on your own. That was really my point.
Right. So like basically, had you arrived now to the seat and you needed somebody there maybe to broker a more adversarial negotiation with the people who were occupying your seats, you would have felt more reassured had there been a member of staff on standby, maybe to back you up, is it?
Yeah, because, these people were lovely and they were more apologetic to me of the fact that they were floating around the train trying to find a place that they could sit and not be interrupted. As soon as the train pulled out, it wasn't an issue. But just for that time with people pulling cases down the aisle and all sorts of things that go on when the train is boarded, You just like to think that if you did go on online, go to the trouble of getting the seat allocation, went on the train, found your way to that seat, you know, where you were promised that, you know, your seat, it even asks you on the ticket sale point, do you want your name displayed? And you can take yes for that, and you're assuming that that's going to happen, just to find a blank screen. And, you know, people already occupying your seat, and then you sort of say to yourself, look, what do I do here? It's not that the train is over busy. Do I just go and find another place, and or do I just sort of, you know, stick to the situation there? Yeah. And
what's your look? As you say, you weren't to know that had you moved to another seat to accommodate the people who were already in your seat, that somebody else wouldn't have arrived along and ended up bumping you out. Patrick, we've a bit of an issue with the line, but we did get the sense of what you were saying. Maurice Flynn, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you.
What was your issue on the train over the weekend?
So we travelled to Dublin for the semi-finals on Saturday.
Right.
No issue travelling up on the train. That's grand, nice and relaxed. Like the previous caller had said, we booked our tickets, booked our seats, names overhead for where you were seated for going up and coming back. The issue, though, stemmed from coming back with regards to, from my scenario, a lack of personnel around Irish Rail.
So, sorry, for anyone who's not aware of the football fixtures over the weekend, you were travelling from Limerick, was it, for the Kildare game?
No, we were actually travelling up from Waterford. So
from Waterford,
for the,
okay.
Yeah, travelling and sporting Kerry lads. So, okay. Yeah, cute Kerry boys.
Yeah, very good.
Fair to them. Yeah, I've just put that in there. Like, I mean, they are cute, like, a little bit, like...
Right. So you got on at the start of the journey. You were on from the beginning. So no issue detected at that end of things.
No issue detected there. Waterford are very good. They're exceptional. So they are, to be fair. Anytime you go in for a train into Waterford, it's opened up on time. You can go up, you get your ticket checked, it's stamped, and you go down into your seat. No problem at all. And normally, to be fair, on the way back, out of Dublin, Euston, it's normally decent enough. But because of the crowd, you had Kildare supporters travelling back, you have Kerry supporters travelling back, you have an awful lot of supporters travelling back all at the one time, going kind of heading in the one direction. But we were booked on the 20 past 8 train on the way back for Waterford. And lo and behold, basically, massive delay. Delay on opening the platform to actually go to the train. There was such a crowd there looking to get on the train that basically it was almost a free-for-all. I'd say there was no way of checking tickets. There was nothing there to be accounted for. I'd say if I went up to the train myself, nobody was there to
right. Was it Euston Station? There's platforms six, seven, and eight, and there's a long old stretch, and normally a bit of a sprint breaks out between the main body of the station and those platforms, and people start to speed walk and run past each other at that stage. Yeah,
spot on, exactly. Yeah, you're well aware. But look, it's from my point of view, if the train is booked to be 20 past 8, you should have the platform opened on time, particularly if the train is sitting there. At least it's an orderly kind of way of people getting there. But it didn't seem to be that at all. It seemed like that the whole thing was just understaffed. When we got in the carriage then, the carriage was absolutely thronged. It was absolutely chock-a-block. Like, I mean, it reminded me of, remember them pictures of... out of the trains and the trams out far, where people were actually sitting on the roofs. That's what it reminded me of. It was that kind of scene, like, you know what I mean? Went down, seats occupied again. Luckily, we met three people who were really nice and easygoing, and they got up off the seats. But we don't know who you're facing. in the modern day, you just don't know who you're facing.
Yeah, or where they might be in the stage of their celebrations at 20 past 10.
Absolutely. Yeah,
now, we did get a response from Irish Rail to your query. It said it was busy on the railways on Saturday to facilitate the extra rail users from Kildare for the Tailteann Cup. Three extra trains to Newbridge were added. Obviously, there's still going to be a lot of Kildare fans on the Waterford train, though, because, you know, the line to Newbridge is one thing, but people travelling to the southeast of the county are obviously going to be on your line. Is that where?
Absolutely. Hmm. Absolutely. But where I have an issue, though, is, okay, grand to say what they're just after saying, but if, for argument's sake, I or you have a ticket with a seat number on it, surely be to God, if they have enough staff members on, they can police it and go, people with tickets with seat numbers on it, can we get them people forward first? They were able to get young kids and their families in first. That's grand. No issue with that, by the way. Okay, but I mean, why should then after that should it be a free for all whereby we're going down to beg? And I'm not saying.
Maybe their attitude is that look, people with the reserved seats will find their way to their seats. They'll ask people if they are, you know, they are by their nature reserved seats. The free for all thing, the free for all people might end up just standing in the aisles and between the carriages, while the reserved people can go up at their ease and take their seats.
Yeah, no issue, but we shouldn't. People in general should not be put in that position, though. Let's be honest about it, because, like you said, and I think we'd all agree, no person in their right mind should actually have to face into that, because with the best will in the world, we don't know what we're facing. You know what I mean? We just don't know what we're facing. We could meet anyone with too much drink on board or in their celebrations. You just don't know. Like, I'm not being harsh on people. Like,
anyway,
no, I just feel that in the modern thing, everyone, public, are being asked to use public transport, and that's the way that we're being treated coming up from the country, and that's what we're having to deal with. And by the way, as well, then going in towards Dublin, not enough Lewis's again. Like, I mean, it's just crazy.
Right.
Just
absolutely happy crazy. Enough with the result, though, anyway.
Ah, sure, look at you. No wonder why you would be. Like, I mean, to be fair, have to face Donegal again in a couple of weeks' time, and sure.
Right.
Donegal will probably win that, and I saw it also.
You think? Are you trying to play down the hype there? Of course, Éireann Ó Éireann might have been looking at it and saying there was a time when Kerry people didn't travel for the semi-final and they weren't factoring in at all.
Yeah, I'd agree there. It's too much. There's too much expense incurred.
You've after shocking them. They're still recovering that you travelled for a semi.
Yeah, they can't believe the amount of people that travelled up from Kerry, probably. That's what it is.
All right. Thanks, Maurice. We'll take a break. We're back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
It's Colm O'Mungain here. Sean, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colm.
We're staying with trains, but specifically stations and their facilities. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I'm a frequent train user from the Midlands. And what I notice is the cities are well served. You've no problem at Houston Station, Cork, Galway, Limerick, Waterford. However, venture into the Midlands or just beyond the pale northwards or south, you'll find very few facilities available at the stations. One in particular, I'd call it a wee problem. The toilets, although there's been massive investment in new fancy toilets, we find them closed frequently.
Mm.
And I'm wondering, as I observe this, and tourists, children, younger people, older people, and going back to your previous caller, it's not very nice to have to try and find a bush. There's not too many bushes on the platform, and then if you venture out, it's actually illegal to be peeing on someone else's doorstep. Isn't that correct?
For sure. Now, look, this is not some, you know, this is something that does affect you because, you know, you have had need in the past to try and find a toilet or a bathroom before the train has arrived at
right.
a station. You might just fill us in on a bit of that to tell people and give them an insight into who's affected by this.
Yeah, at many stations, like You only have to travel on an early morning train and you see people heading up for their hospital appointments. James's, Vincent's, centres of excellence, and they're called that for a reason, and they are excellent. So we travel up, and because of various conditions, you become more aware of the lack of facilities at stations. And then I'm there, and tourists ask me, excuse me, where's the toilet? I said, it's there. Oh, it's closed. The mother with the buggy and two children. Somebody wants to go, and she said, I told you to go before you left. But that doesn't help the situation.
No, right.
So it's all age groups are affected. And, of course, I took the subject up with Éireann Road Éireann because they're very good. I have to admire their marketing, their media, the corporate media. In fact, you could say they have an inside track on radio programmes.
Well, that's your second pun. You might get a third one in before we're out.
I know, but just I'd like the idea of customer service to come back to rural stations.
Now, I'm familiar with one station, as you say, in the Midlands on the line, the main kind of southwestern line, where there was considerable money spent on the upgrade of the station building there. There was a ticket office put in, which I think is no longer in use because it's mostly down to machines now. And I do remember when it was open, going into it and inquiring if the toilet could be used. And I was told that it was for staff use only.
Correct. That's a problem. And I think I'm not putting this down to staff because generally they have, I don't know how many functions the people at the station have. They're waving the green flag, they're behind the desk, but they're definitely not there to answer customer questions. They do their job and then they go and disappear because perhaps they've other things to do. But the toilet facilities, after having spent the capital on it, and I understand issues like unsocial behaviour, but other countries seem to manage it.
Right. Other countries, you know, but also they have pay toilets and that kind of thing. Would you be prepared to put up with that if that was the solution?
Of course you would. Of course you would. Like, when you have the need, it would be called a captive market, wouldn't it?
It would. It's not called spending a penny for nothing. All right, Sean, we're going to take another break. Back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Now, of course, there are the good rail stories. Susanna Carr, you have one of them. The story of a good Samaritan. Who benefited from it?
Hi, Colm. Yeah, so it was my mum who benefited from it on this occasion. And she was travelling down to Carlow last week to visit her cousin. So my mum is elderly and she also has issues with her knee, so she uses a stick to walk. So she's not as agile as she used to be, a very sprightly elderly woman all the same.
Right.
But I accompanied her to Houston train station. It was very busy. Everybody was very kind. The guy, the ticket collector at the gate, let me through so I could assist her getting on the train. And we found her seat, sat down. And I moved her luggage down to the luggage compartment and, you know, reassured her and said, look, ma'am, there's your luggage and it's not too far for you to walk to get. And I was a little bit concerned about her disembarking because of the problems that she has with her knees. So I got off the train and I was walking back up the platform. It was due to leave 5 minutes later. And I met a gentleman coming towards me. He was wearing the Éireann Road Éireann uniform. And I just stopped him and said, look, by any chance, do you know if this train is terminating in Carlow or is it going all the way to Waterford? And he said, no, it's going to Carlow, stopping in Carlow. That's where it finishes. And he said, why are you asking? And I said, well, my mum is on the train and I would just love, I'm going to get back on to tell her that she doesn't have to worry about rushing to get her luggage when she gets off. Now, he knew by the look of me that I was no spring chicken. So he obviously gathered that my mum was, you know, elderly. And he said, you don't need to worry. I will look after her. He said, where's she sitting? And I said, she's in carriage A. And he said, she's directly behind me and she'll be fine. So I went off happy on my way. I thought, that's great. I don't, you know, don't have to be concerned about her getting off the train in a rush. And he had said, no, you don't need to get back on. The train was due to depart, and I left.
Right, carriage A is the front carriage, is it?
It's the front carriage. So it was only after I walked away from that I thought, crikey, he must be the train driver. So
right, yeah.
I just didn't put, you know, I didn't pay any more attention to it. I went home, I had a busy day planned, and I came home. And later on that evening, I was talking to my mum, and she told me that when the train pulled into Carlow station, a gentleman approached her minutes later and said to her, you are to stay exactly where you are, and I will be back to you in 5 minutes. And she did that. She had no idea who this gentleman was, but she knew he worked here in Rod Éireann because I was in his uniform on. 5 minutes later, true to his word, he reappeared. He assisted her out of the seat and gathered up her luggage, helped her off the train and walked along the platform with her, whereupon she saw her cousin's grandson, who was picking her up, approaching them. And she said to him, I'm fine from here. And he said, you're very welcome. And she went on her merry way.
Okay.
And I just thought that little random act of kindness, he didn't know me. It was unnecessary. He didn't, you know, he didn't ask, like, you know, who, like, where my mum, you know, how old my mum was or where was she going. Or he just reassured me and said, you do not have to worry. I will look after her. So it was a very, you know,
basic,
lovely thing on his part.
Basic human decency. Unlike some of the stories we heard at the very top of the programme. So it's nice to finish on a high note with a vote of confidence in humanity. Thanks very much, Suzanne.